Hello. Are you out there? Here we are again. It's the Pinky Pod. Pip, 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 pow. And all that. Blah, blah. I need coffee. Okay, that's just... You don't want to hear that, do you? All right. All right. We're back again with more spooky season. I think we'll just get right to it because this could be a long one depending. You'll see. Just listen along and find out. What is the subject today? What is the subject today? Well, come in, dear listeners. Come in, have a sit, cop a squat, and listen as I tell you a tale. You know him, or at least you know some of his tales. Perhaps one in particular. Because I recall, as a child, the animated version of this one particular story, and it was one of my favorite creepy Halloween watches. It's a ghost story. It involves a coward, a horse, and a man who lost his head. Of course, we are talking about the legend of Sleepy Hollow. It hits all the right notes for a ghost story. You got the boogeyman, comes out after dark, secluded places. When you're out alone, that's when you're going to run into him. And if you do run into him, it's not going to end well, my friends. You're probably going to die. So, it's practically the perfect ghost story if you think about it. Those basic fears work really well. They work the best of all, you know, the fear of the dark, fear of the unknown. And being headless is pretty creepy. You weave the tale around this with such good suspense and turn of phrase, and the payoff is epic, right? That's what we hope for anyway. What made this particular tale so enduring and so famous? Well, in great part because Washington Irving wrote it, and he was quite good. He was born April 3rd, 1783, and died November 28th, 1859. He wrote several things, in fact, including a little tale called Rip Van Winkle. But Sleepy Hollow came out in about 1820, along with Rip Van Winkle, and he was born in Manhattan, and that's where he was raised. He debuted his writing in 1802 under the pen name Jonathan Oldstyle. For some reason, that tickles me. Oldstyle. They were observational letters, as they were called, published to the Morning Chronicle. He then spent a brief time in England, approximately 1815, I think it was, maybe 1817, maybe for a couple of years there. He has the distinction of being one of the first American writers to be acclaimed in Europe. And not only did he encourage other writers such as Longfellow, Melville, you know him, A Tale About a Whale, Hawthorne, and Poe, also a great subject for spooky season, go read you some Poe. Some of Irving's fans were Lord Byron, who I mentioned a couple of podcast episodes ago, Dickens, yes, that one, Scott, and Mary Shelley. Irving was rather progressive for his time in arguing for stronger copyright protections and pushing writing as a legitimate profession. Thank you, Irving, Washington Irving, we salute you. His father was from Scotland. His mother was from Cornwall. He was one of 11 children. Man, a lot of these I've been doing lately, they're just having a plethora of sex. I mean, children. Well, there had to be a lot of sex going on as well. Unfortunately, three of the children, as you know, it was very common, especially in these times, did not make it into adulthood. I believe, I didn't write it down, that Irving was like the fourth child. Trivia moment for you. He was born in the same week that New York City residents learned of the British ceasefire, which marked an end to the American Revolution. Now, his family was part of the merchant class. They were fairly well off. Wonderfully, they supported his literary pursuits. Even his, like, brothers, you know, they would lend him money. They would support him. Very cool. Not everyone gets that. He preferred adventures and drama as stories, so he'd often sneak out of class to attend theater. plays, you know, things like that. Yellow fever in 1798 saw his family send him off for a time for his own safety. And in fact, I believe the entire family went somewhere. They had enough money to be able to do that. A lot of people in the city unfortunately didn't and died, but he stayed with a pal named James Kirk Paulding in a little place called Tarrytown, New York. And this is when he became familiar with a very nearby area, like less than 10 miles or so. That would be Sleepy Hollow, which was full of Dutch customs and ghost tales. I could tell you so much more about Washington Irving, but my biography here would just not do him justice. We are focused in on the legend of Sleepy Hollow for this episode, but I do invite you to read up on him sometime because he's very major in history, okay? He even popularized, I'll give you some more trivia, popularized the name Gotham for New York City. He is also credited for the phrase the almighty dollar. And there's more, but the dude still has a major impact on us to this day and pop culture and all kinds of things. And if you're wondering why Gotham, the name was based on an old folktale about residents in Gotham, Nottinghamshire, England. It's called the Wise Men of Gotham. So there is an actual place named that, apparently, or at least in the folktale. Hey, my British people out there, I forgot to stop and Google that. Does that still exist, or was that for a folktale? He started using the name in a November 11th, 1807 issue of Salmagundi, which was a satirical periodical that he wrote. He might have been making a commentary when he used it about the wise but also foolish nature of the city. And it does fit with the folktale. If you go read the folktale, I saw a bit of it. The name stuck. And, you know, if you like Batman even a little bit, well, you know that. You've heard it. Now you know where it comes from. They did not just make this up for the film. And if you think about Gotham in the Batman movies, wise but foolish, yeah, it's making a statement. There's more meaning behind that nickname than just like, hey, that sounds cool. But let's go back in time a little bit, even before Washington Irving wrote this, to examine this entire idea of a headless horseman. You hear tales about this in various lore in Europe, folklore, even in Scandinavia, particularly Northern Europe. You have the Dullahan, which is a Celtic legend. It's sort of a demon, rides around on a black horse, just can race along, apparently, show up anywhere. Of course, it's headless, but you know, they don't really need eyes if they're demons now, do they? They can just go wherever the hell they want, and they do. In an Arthurian tale, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which you've probably heard of, this knight, or it's a green giant, and I wasn't going to say that because I'm like, green giant. Any of you know Jolly Green Giant? Is that just outdated now, Jolly Green Giant as a brand? Okay, anyway, he's beheaded. But Gawain watches this beheaded guy grab his head and ride off. So that's pretty fucked up and creepy. Germany has the Wild Huntsman, or Der Wild Jäger, by Gottfried August Berger. And there are tales by Karl Massal. These writers in the tales are bad omens. You do not want to encounter these guys, okay? And yes, they do have some influence on your Wild Hunt stories, like in The Witcher 3, The Wild Hunt, which I've played like 7 times, and I'm waiting for the PS5 update. I said it, I love that. It's no stretch to think, of course, that Irving, who was way into stories and already writing for quite a while, would be familiar with some of these folk tales and mythologies. There are a plethora of references to decapitation in folklore, other than even just these stories. So much so that even old Freud talked about it, and he spoke on the castration complex in a book called The Medusa Head, I think. Yeah, figure out that whole title. It's purported by some people to represent a fear of castration or maybe loss of masculinity. I don't know, I haven't read that. All I know is that if you see something running around and without a head, that's pretty freaking creepy all by itself. You don't need the rest of it. I mean, you know, chickens really do that, FYI. Have you ever seen it? Yeah, it's freaky. But having said all of that, just touched upon it very quickly. A story that followed the American Revolution is probably the biggest inspiration for the legend of Sleepy Hollow. And that would be the story about the Hessian soldier, which was played with great aplomb by Christopher Walken in the movie. Quote, gigantic in height and muffled in a cloak, Ichabod was horror-struck on perceiving that he was headless. But his horror was still more increased on observing that the head, which should have rested on his shoulders, was carried before him on the pommel of his saddle. And that's from the story, of course. What's a Hessian? Those were German troops who aided America against the British. And the one who became immortalized was decapitated by a cannonball at the Battle of White Plains in 1776. In one telling, it said that he was buried at the old Dutch church in Sleepy Hollow. The belief, of course, was that he'd rise at night looking for his head, and if you were unlucky enough to see him or run into him, it was a death sentence for you. It didn't always mean that he was going to attack you and kill you himself. It could also be an omen that, you know, something terrible was going to befall you, but it was a death sentence, however it happened. Whether or not you believe in ghosts, there are in fact historical records of a decapitated Hessian soldier. Major General William Heath actually wrote in his 1798 memoir, "A shot from an American cannon at this place took off the head of a Hessian artilleryman," this place being White Plains. And damn, he got killed by friendly fire. He's probably a bit miffed by that, do you think? Maybe that's why he's out haunting the place. "You asshole shot me," however you say that in German. "I was on your side." There is also a soldier named Anthony Maxwell who was a witness and apparently talked about this for years afterwards. I probably would too if I'm, you know, sitting right next to it all of a sudden like, "Oh my God, where's his head?" The old Dutch church was erected in 1697, where he's said to be buried, and it's still there. It's still there. So this is a well-loved, well-known story in the Northeast. Irving was approximately 15 when he went to Tarrytown, and he visited many places during this time frame, and even after he was able to go back to New York. He talks about spending a lot of time in the Catskill. He said they had a witching effect on his imagination. He loved all the Dutch architecture, all the stories. Some of the other things that he wrote were very inspired by these trips and have the atmosphere of the Catskills and, you know, northeastern towns. The Sleepy Hollow village in his story is in fact modeled after Tarrytown, and he named some of the characters in the books after real people. He even went farther than that. Some of the characters in the books are loosely based on very real people. Ichabod, in fact, might be one Jesse Mervin. I can't read my own handwriting. Mervin. This person was a teacher from upstate and a friend of Irving. They had like mutual friends. But other people say that it might be Samuel Youngs, who was a lieutenant from Tarrytown. It could be a combination of both. You know, I told you in the last episode, I think, or one of those, we authors, you know, we just were little sponges. That was a bad, like, Silence of the Lamb sound instead of what I intended. I don't know what a sponge sounds like. I suddenly can't speak. Take two. Where was I? Oh, yes. We soak up details. You never know when they're going to end up in the story. We don't know when they're going to end up in the story. You just observe people, and this is where you get, you know, personalities get all mushed up together, right? Right. Okay. I sort of spit that out. Let's carry on. It might interest you to know that there was actually a real Ichabod Crane. Colonel Ichabod B. Crane, served during the War of 1812 at Fort Pike under New York Governor Daniel D. Tompkins. We cannot, however, prove that Irving ever met this guy, but they were stationed in the same area, I read somewhere. I think it's a good guess that Irving at least heard the name and liked it, because I know if I was an author, I'd be like, ooh, that's a good one. I'm going to use that. And some people have said about him that he really enjoyed coming up with very different, like, Yankee names. Seriously, who comes up with a name like Ichabod out of thin air? Except, of course, for Ichabod's parents. Then you have Katrina von Tassel, which is Ichabod's unrequited love, yes, from the story. This is possibly somewhat at least based on Eleanor Van Tassel Brush. He would describe Katrina in the story as plump as a partridge, that's a compliment, okay? Ripe and melting, and rosy-cheeked as one of her father's peaches. Oh, I don't think he wanted to get some. Tara von Tassel, Van Tassel, again, I can't read my own writing, Tara von Tassel, who is an actual descendant of this very real family in Sleepy Hollow, has said that it's a name taken from a gravestone that he probably used and an amalgamation of several people. Within the story, there's even a little plague that hits the town, which might actually be an allusion to the mosquito-borne yellow fever that I mentioned just moments ago that killed approximately 5,000 people in New York City. I mean, the entire reason that he fled the area for a while. It's kind of morbid to say, but because of that, we end up with the legend of Sleepy Hollow. He was actually suffering from writer's block for a while, and during a lot of this time, and when he went to, through the Catskills and all that. Then he goes to England. The reason that he went to England is that his family business had gone bankrupt in 1817, and he didn't feel that he had any good job prospects in America, or at least, around there in New York. He was doing kind of okay as a writer, but again, he had like major writer's block when it came to any like novels or full, short stories, things like that. He goes to England, and that's where he overcame his writer's block and was inspired while speaking to a brother-in-law about his old Sleepy Hollow, Tarrytown, Catskill time of life. They were talking about it. He was relaying things that he'd seen and heard. So inspired, and I love this when it happens as a writer, it's happened to me before, he wrote all night, through the entire night, and his bleary-eyed family in the morning, they were barely even dressed, didn't even have break their fast yet, got to read the first chapters of what became The Sketchbook. That's actually a collection of shorts, and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is one of the tales, and I believe also Rip Van Winkle is another one that's in that collection. It got rave reviews, y'all. They even loved it in England. He earned the accolade from England, the finest British writer produced by America. Woo! I wonder if that burned some other people's egos. The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is the sixth story in the book. And I was considering maybe I should read it to you. I found, of course, good old Project Gutenberg. I will also put the link so you guys can read it. I don't know how long it will take. It's a little bit longer than I thought, but it's still a short story. Let's see here. We'll see how far we get. And maybe I'll leave you hanging. Let's talk a little bit about how this still affects pop culture. 1922 is the first known screen adaptation, which, funnily enough, is also the same year of Nosferatu, both silent films. The one about Sleepy Hollow, of course, is just called Headless Horseman. There's 1999's Sleepy Hollow by Tim Burton. Yeah, that one with Christopher Walken. He doesn't really have dialogue, otherwise we'd probably have some really great memes. I own that one. I like that one. It's fun. There was a 2013 TV series It was a good idea. I watched most of it. I think I missed some of the last season. It was sometimes a little uneven, but it was fun. They reimagined the Hessian soldier, the headless horseman, as being one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And Ichabod, because yes, there was an Ichabod, had ended up in our time, in the present time. I think, I'm trying to remember, I think, yeah, he was brought back from the grave somehow. So needless to say, he was a bit confused. The town was a bit confused in a very funny way. And then they decided that he wasn't just totally batshit, and he makes friends with this policeman, because of course I think she was investigating him at first, like, what is up with this weirdo? Where did he come from? Who are you? And it, of course, made for a few laughs throughout the series because he was still kind of living in the past. This is probably our most retold ghost story, and Spooky Season would not be complete without it.
And there you have a little backstory on the story. And I thought perhaps I would read you just a bit of the actual story. But we'll skip all the setup and just get to the part that everyone likes the best, right? The spooky part, the scary parts. I'm going to begin where they're at a party, quite the spread, of the house of the Van Tassels, the house where the woman that Ichabod loves, as well as her fortune, resides. And they start telling like ghost stories, okay? When the dance was at an end, Ichabod was attracted to a knot of the sager folks who, with old Van Tassel, sat smoking at one end of the piazza, gossiping over former times and drawing out long stories about the war. This neighborhood, at the time of which I am speaking, was one of those highly favored places which abound with chronicles and great men. The British and American line had run near it during the war. It had, therefore, been the scene of marauding and infested with refugees, cowboys, and all kinds of border chivalry. Just sufficient time had elapsed to enable each storyteller to dress up his tale with a little becoming fiction and, in the indistinctness of his recollection, to make himself the hero of every exploit. There was the story of Dafu Martling, a large blue-bearded Dutchman who had early taken a British frigate with an old iron 9-pounder from a mud breastwork, only that his gun burst at the sixth discharge. And then there was an old gentleman who shall be nameless, being too rich a mioneer to be lightly mentioned, who, in the Battle of White Plains, being an excellent master of defense, parried a musket ball with a small sword, insomuch that he absolutely felt it whiz round the blade and glance off at the hilt, in proof of which he was ready at any time to show the sword, with the hilt a little bent. There were several more that had been equally great in the field, not one of whom but was persuaded that he had a considerable hand in bringing the war to a happy termination. But all these were nothing to the tales of ghosts and apparitions that succeeded. The neighborhood is rich in legendary treasures of the kind. Local tales and superstitions thrive best in these sheltered, long-settled retreats, but are trampled underfoot by the shifting throng that forms the population of most of our country places. Besides, there is no encouragement for ghosts in most of our villages, for they have scarcely had time to finish their first nap and turn themselves in their graves before their surviving friends have all traveled away from the neighborhood, so that when they turn out at night to walk their rounds, they have no acquaintance left to call upon. This is perhaps the reason why we so seldom hear of ghosts, except in our long-established Dutch communities. The immediate cause, however, of the prevalence of supernatural stories in these parts was doubtless owing to the vicinity of Sleepy Hollow. There was a contagion in the very air that blew from that haunted region. It breathed forth an atmosphere of dreams and fancies infecting all the land. Several of the Sleepy Hollow people were present at Van Tassel's and, as usual, were doling out their wild and wonderful legends. Many dismal tales were told about funeral trains and mourning cries and wailings heard and seen about the great tree where the unfortunate Major Andre was taken and which stood in the neighborhood. Some mention was made also of the woman in white that haunted the dark glen at Raven Rock and was often heard to shriek on winter nights before a storm, having perished there in the snow. The chief part of the stories, however, turned upon the favorite specter of Sleepy Hollow, the Headless Horseman, who had been heard several times of late patrolling the country, and, it was said, tethered his horse nightly among the graves in the churchyard. The sequestered situation of this church seems always to have made it a favorite haunt of troubled spirits. It stands on a knoll, surrounded by locust trees and lofty elms, from among which its decent, whitewashed walls shine modestly forth, like Christian purity beaming through the shades of retirement. A gentle slope descends from it to a silver sheet of water, bordered by high trees, between which peeps may be caught at the blue hills of the Hudson. To look upon its grass-grown yard, where the sunbeams seem to sleep so quietly, one would think that there at least the dead might rest in peace. On one side of the church extends a woody dell, along which raves a large brook among broken rocks and trunks of fallen trees. Over a deep black part of the stream, not far from the church, was formerly thrown a wooden bridge. The road that led to it, and the bridge itself, were thickly shaded by overhanging trees, which cast a gloom about it even in the daytime, but occasioned a fearful darkness at night. Such was one of the favorite haunts of the Headless Horseman, and the place where he was most frequently encountered. The tale was told of old Brower, a most heretical disbeliever in ghosts, and how he met the horseman returning from his foray into Sleepy Hollow, and was obliged to get up behind him. How they galloped over bush and brake, over hill and swamp, until they reached the bridge, when the horseman suddenly turned into a skeleton, threw old Brower into the brook, and sprang away over the treetops with a clap of thunder. This story was immediately matched by a thrice marvelous adventure of Brom Bones, who made light of the galloping Hessian as an errant jockey. He affirmed that on returning one night from the neighboring village of Sing Sing, he had been overtaken by this midnight trooper, that he had offered to race with him for a bowl of punch, and should have won it too, for Daredevil beat the goblin horse all hollow. But just as they came to the church bridge, the Hessian bolted and vanished in a flash of fire. All these tales, told in that drowsy undertone with which men talk in the dark, the countenances of listeners only now and then receiving a casual gleam from the glare of a pipe, sank deep in the mind of Ichabod. He repaid them in kind with large extracts from his invaluable author, Cotton Mather, and added many marvelous events that had taken place in his native state of Connecticut, and fearful sights which he had seen in his nightly walks about Sleepy Hollow. The revel now gradually broke up. The old farmers gathered together their families in their wagons and were heard for some time rattling among the hollow roads and over the distant hills. Some of the damsels mounted on pillions behind their favorite swains, and their light-hearted laughter, mingling with the clatter of hoofs, echoed along the silent woodlands, sounding fainter and fainter until they gradually died away, and the late scene of noise and frolic was all silent and deserted. Ichabod only lingered behind, according to the custom of country lovers, to have a tête-à-tête with the heiress, fully convinced that he was now on the high road to success. What passed at this interview I will not pretend to say, for in fact I do not know. Something, however, I fear me, must have gone wrong, for he certainly sallied forth, after no very great interval, with an air quite desolate and chapfallen. Oh, these women, these women! Could that girl have been playing off any of her coquettish tricks? Was her encouragement of the poor pedagogue all a mere sham to secure her conquest of his rival? Heaven only knows, not I. Let it suffice to say, Ichabod stole forth with the air of one who had been sacking a hen roost rather than a fair lady's heart. Without looking to the right or left to notice the scene of rural wealth on which he had so often gloated, he went straight to the stable, and with several hearty cuffs and kicks roused his steed most uncourteously from the comfortable quarters in which he was soundly sleeping, dreaming of mountains of corn and oats, and whole valleys of timothy and clover. It was the very witching time of the night that Ichabod, heavy-hearted and crestfallen, pursued his travels homewards along the sides of the lofty hills which rise above Tarrytown, and which he had traversed so cheerily in the afternoon. The hour was as dismal as himself. Far below him the Tappan Zee spread its dusky and indistinct waste of waters, with here and there the tall mast of a sloop riding quietly at anchor under the land. In the dead hush of midnight, he could even hear the barking of the watchdog from the opposite shore of the Hudson, but it was so vague and faint as only to give an idea of his distance from this faithful companion of man. Now and then, too, the long-drawn crowing of a cock, accidentally awakened, would sound far, far off from some farmhouse away among the hills, but it was like a dreaming sound in his ear. No signs of life occurred near him, but occasionally the melancholy chirp of a cricket, or perhaps the guttural twang of a bullfrog from a neighboring marsh, as if sleeping uncomfortably and turning suddenly in his bed. All the stories of ghosts and goblins that he had heard in the afternoon now came crowding upon his recollection. The night grew darker and darker. The stars seemed to sink deeper in the sky, and driving clouds occasionally hid them from his sight. He had never felt so lonely and dismal. He was, moreover, approaching the very place where many of the scenes of the ghost stories had been laid. In the center of the road stood an enormous tulip tree, which towered like a giant above all the other trees of the neighborhood and formed a kind of landmark. Its limbs were gnarled and fantastic, large enough to form trunks for ordinary trees, twisting down almost to the earth and rising again into the air. It was connected with the tragical story of the unfortunate André, who had been taken prisoner hard by, and was universally known by the name of Major André's tree. The common people regarded it with a mixture of respect and superstition, partly out of sympathy for the fate of its ill-starred namesake, and partly from the tales of strange sights and doleful lamentations told concerning it. As Ichabod approached this fearful tree, he began to whistle. He thought his whistle was answered. It was but a blast sweeping sharply through the dry branches. As he approached a little nearer, he thought he saw something white hanging in the midst of the tree. He paused and ceased whistling, but, on looking more narrowly, perceived that it was a place where the tree had been scathed by lightning, and the white wood laid bare. Suddenly he heard a groan. His teeth chattered, and his knees smote against the saddle. It was but the rubbing of one huge bough upon another, as they were swayed about by the breeze. He passed the tree in safety, but new perils lay before him. About 200 yards from the tree, a small brook crossed the road and ran into a marshy and thickly wooded glen known by the name of Wiley Swamp. A few rough logs laid side by side served for a bridge over this stream. On that side of the road where the brook entered the wood, a group of oaks and chestnuts matted thick with wild grapevines threw a cavernous gloom over it. To pass this bridge was the severest trial. It was at this identical spot that the unfortunate André was captured, and under the covert of these chestnuts and vines were the sturdy yeomen concealed who surprised him. This has ever since been considered a haunted stream, and fearful are the feelings of the schoolboy who has to pass it alone after dark. As he approached the stream, his heart began to thump. He summoned up, however, all his resolution, gave his horse half a score of kicks in his ribs, and attempted to dash briskly across the bridge. But instead of starting forward, the perverse old animal made a lateral movement and ran broadside against the fence. Ichabod, whose fears increased with the delay, jerked the reins on the other side and kicked lustily with the contrary foot. It was all in vain. His steed started, it is true, but it was only to plunge to the opposite side of the road into a thicket of brambles and alder bushes. The schoolmaster now bestowed both whip and heel upon the starveling ribs of old Gunpowder, who dashed forward, snuffling and snorting, but came to a stand just by the bridge, with a suddenness that had nearly sent his rider sprawling over his head. Just at this moment, a plashy tramp by the side of the bridge caught the sensitive ear of Ichabod. In the dark shadow of the grove, on the margin of the brook, he beheld something huge, misshapen, and towering. It stirred not, but seemed gathered up in the gloom, like some gigantic monster ready to spring upon the traveler. The hair of the affrighted pedagogue rose upon his head with terror. What was to be done? To turn and fly was now too late. And besides, what chance was there of escaping ghost or goblin, if such it was, which could ride upon the wings of the wind? Summoning up, therefore, a show of courage, he demanded in stammering accents, "Who are you?" He received no reply.
He repeated his demand in a still more agitated voice. Still there was no answer. Once more he cudgeled the sides of the inflexible gunpowder and, shutting his eyes, broke forth with involuntary fervor into a psalm tune. Just then the shadowy object of alarm put itself in motion, and with a scramble and a bound stood at once in the middle of the road. Though the night was dark and dismal, the form of the unknown might now in some degree be ascertained. He appeared to be a horseman of large dimensions, and mounted on a black horse of powerful frame. He made no offer of molestation or sociability, but kept aloof on the side of the road, jogging along the blind side of old Gunpowder, who had now got over his fright and waywardness. Ichabod, who had no relish for this strange midnight companion, and bethought himself of the adventure of Brom Bones with the galloping Hessian, now quickened his steed in hopes of leaving him behind. The stranger, however, quickened his horse to an equal pace. Ichabod pulled up and fell into a walk, thinking to lag behind. The other did the same. His heart began to sink within him. He endeavored to resume his psalm tune, but his parched tongue clove to the roof of his mouth, and he could not utter a stave. There was something in the moody and dogged silence of this pernicious companion that was mysterious and appalling. It was soon fearfully accounted for. On mounting a rising ground, which brought the figure of his fellow traveler in relief against the sky, gigantic in height and muffled in a cloak, Ichabod was horror-struck on perceiving that he was headless. But his horror was still more increased on observing that the head, which should have rested on his shoulders, was carried before him on the pommel of his saddle. His terror rose to desperation. He rained a shower of kicks and blows upon Gunpowder, hoping by a sudden movement to give his companion the slip. But the spectre started full jump with him. Away, then, they dashed through thick and thin, stones flying and sparks flashing at every bound. Ichabod's flimsy garments fluttered in the air as he stretched his long, lank body away over his horse's head in the eagerness of his flight. They had now reached the road which turns off to Sleepy Hollow. But Gunpowder, who seemed possessed with a demon, instead of keeping up it, made an opposite turn and plunged headlong downhill to the left. This road leads through a sandy hollow shaded by trees for about a quarter of a mile, where it crosses the bridge famous in goblin story, and just beyond swells the green knoll on which stands the whitewashed church. As yet the panic of the steed had given his unskillful rider an apparent advantage in the chase, but just as he had got halfway through the hollow, the girths of the saddle gave way, and he felt it slipping from under him. He seized it by the pommel and endeavored to hold up it firm, but in vain, and had just time to save himself by clasping old Gunpowder round the neck, when the saddle fell to the earth, and he heard it trampled underfoot by his pursuer. For a moment, the terror of Hans Van Ripper's wrath passed across his mind, for it was his Sunday saddle. But this was no time for petty fears. The goblin was hard on his haunches, and, unskillful rider that he was, he had much ado to maintain his seat, sometimes slipping on one side, sometimes on another, and sometimes jolted on the high ridge of his horse's backbone with a violence that he verily feared would cleave him asunder. An opening in the trees now cheered him with the hopes that the church bridge was at hand. The wavering reflection of a silver star in the bosom of the brook told him that he was not mistaken. He saw the walls of the church dimly glaring under the trees beyond. He recollected the place where Brom Bones's ghostly competitor had disappeared. "If I can but reach that bridge," thought Ichabod, "I am safe." Just then he heard the black steed panting and blowing close behind him. He even fancied that he felt his hot breath. Another convulsive kick in the ribs, and old Gunpowder sprang upon the bridge. He thundered over the resounding planks. He gained the opposite side, and now Ichabod cast a look behind to see if his pursuer should vanish, according to the rule, in a flash of fire and brimstone. Just then he saw the goblin rising in his stirrups, and in the very act of hurling his head at him. Ichabod endeavored to dodge the horrible missile, but too late. It encountered his cranium with a tremendous crash. He was tumbled headlong into the dust, and Gunpowder, the black steed, and the goblin rider passed by like a whirlwind.
The next morning, the old horse was found without his saddle and with the bridle under his feet, soberly cropping the grass at his master's gate. Ichabod did not make his appearance at breakfast. Dinner hour came, but no Ichabod. The boys assembled at the schoolhouse and strolled idly about the banks of the brook, but no schoolmaster. Hans Van Ripper now began to feel some uneasiness about the fate of poor Ichabod and his saddle. An inquiry was set on foot, and after diligent investigation, they came upon his traces. In one part of the road leading to the church was found the saddle trampled in the dirt, the tracks of horses' hooves deeply dented in the road and evidently at furious speed were traced to the bridge, beyond which, on the bank of a broad part of the brook, where the water ran deep and black, was found the hat of the unfortunate Ichabod, and close beside it, a shattered pumpkin. The brook was searched, but the body of the schoolmaster was not to be discovered. Hans Van Ripper, as executor of his estate, examined the bundle which contained all his worldly effects. It consisted of 2 shirts and a half, 2 stocks for the neck, a pair or two of worsted stockings, an old pair of corduroy small clothes, a rusty razor, a book of psalm tunes full of dog's ears, and a broken pitch pipe. As to the books and furniture of the schoolhouse, they belonged to the community, excepting Cotton Mather's History of Witchcraft, a New England almanac, and a book of dreams and fortune-telling, in which last was a sheet of foolscap, much scribbled and blotted in several fruitless attempts to make a copy of verses in honor of the heiress of Van Tassel. These magic books and poetic scrawl were forthwith consigned to the flames by Hans Van Ripper, who, from that time forward, determined to send his children no more to school, observing that he never knew any good to come of this same reading and writing. Whatever money the schoolmaster possessed, and he had received his quarter's pay but a day or two before, he must have had about his person at the time of his disappearance. The mysterious event caused much speculation at the church on the following Sunday. Knots of gazers and gossips were collected in the churchyard, at the bridge, and at the spot where the hat and pumpkin had been found. The stories of Brower, of Bones, and a whole budget of others were called to mind, and when they had diligently considered them all, and compared them with the symptoms of the present case, they shook their heads and came to the conclusion that Ichabod had been carried off by the galloping Hessian. As he was a bachelor, and in nobody's debt, nobody troubled his head any more about him. The school was removed to a different quarter of the hollow, and another pedagogue reigned in his stead. It is true, an old farmer, who had been down to New York on a visit several years after, and from whom this account of the ghostly adventure was received, brought home the intelligence that Ichabod Crane was still alive, that he had left the neighborhood partly through fear of the goblin and Hans Van Ripper, and partly in mortification at having been suddenly dismissed by the heiress, that he had changed his quarters to a distant part of the country, had kept school and studied law at the same time, had been admitted to the bar, turned politician, electioneered, written for the newspapers, and finally had been made a justice of the 10-pound court. Brom Bones, too, who shortly after his rival's disappearance conducted the blooming Katrina in triumph to the altar, was observed to look exceedingly knowing whenever the story of Ichabod was related, and always burst into a hearty laugh at the mention of the pumpkin, which led some to suspect that he knew more about the matter than he chose to tell. The old country wives, however, who are the best judges of these matters, maintain to this day that Ichabod was spirited away by supernatural means, and it is a favorite story often told about the neighborhood round the winter evening fire. The bridge became more than ever an object of superstitious awe, and that may be the reason why the road has been altered of late years, so as to approach the church by the border of the mill pond. The schoolhouse being deserted soon fell to decay, and was reported to be haunted by the ghost of the unfortunate pedagogue, and the plowboy, loitering homeward of a still summer evening, has often fancied his voice at a distance, chanting a melancholy psalm tune among the tranquil solitudes of Sleepy Hollow. And there's the part that everybody probably remembers from that animation. It is a Disney film that I'm talking about. I didn't go through the descriptions of Ichabod and everything. I will link this. You can read it for free. There's even postscripts after this. It's told as if someone else is telling you the story. You know, they heard the story, and now they're telling you, which is pretty clever.
It's a Knickerbocker, I think, is the person. There's a postscript by, you know, these fictional people. Anyway, I will tell you that the description of Ichabod Crane is exactly the way the Disney movie did it. I mean, reading this, it's like, wow, they really nailed it, okay? He is described exactly like that, tall and a hooked nose and this whole thing, just like you might remember with the big Adam's apple and that whole thing, you know, knock-kneed, skinny as a beanpole, with a voracious appetite. I didn't realize, you know, how well they'd done. It's been a long time since I've seen that, but I would assume it's on Disney Plus. Now that I think about it, I might have to watch it. Might have to watch it for Halloween. And there you have it. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope, I haven't ever really read it out loud, and in fact, it's been forever since I read it. I'm sure I did, but, you know, I don't remember parts of it. What I remember is from the movie, although it really follows this quite well, I have to say. So you'll get a great idea if you watch that or if you've ever watched it. I'm repeating myself now. I'm going to stop that. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. We'll come up with something good again for the next episode of Pinkie Pod and Spooky Season. If you have any really good ghost stories that you like, you can always write to me, sroyd@pinkyswearpress.com. Find me on Twitter, podpinky. Instagram, pinky_podcast. My official website, pinkyswearpress.com. Check out my latest book, Dark Wings, sroyd. Amazon, all countries, paperback and Kindle, Kindle Unlimited, which lets you read, you know, books for free with your membership. And for the Paris Immortal people out there, the omnibus is getting close. It really is, okay? It's going to be this year. Sooner than you think. Maybe. Hopefully. I don't want to be like George R.R. Martin and, you know, and promise and then it doesn't deliver. Oh, I said it. It's really not a dig at him. Sorry. By the way, that reminds me. Are you enjoying House of the Dragon? Whoo! Episode 4. My. And that's all I'm going to say about that. Poo-pow! Oh, and be nice to your horses because, you know, you never know when they might save your life. And at least keep pumpkin juice off you.